Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 202. How do you verify and validate the data coming into your Python web application? What tools and security practices should you consider as a developer? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week, bringing another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We discuss the recent Real Python tutorial, Pydantic, Simplifying Data Validation in Python. The piece covers installing the library with optional dependencies, working with base models, validating functions, and managing environment variables. We continue our conversation about web development with another article about Python security best practices. This article covers several Python libraries and crucial steps you can take to help make your web-based applications more secure. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a news roundup, why Python lists multiply oddly, inline run dependencies in pipx, a discussion about open source contribution assignments, playing sounds in Python, and a Python library to access ISO country definitions. This episode is sponsored by Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. Try for free at mailtrap.io. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Chris, welcome back to the show.
Hey there.
This week, we have a large collection of small news items, and then our typical topics, a couple different things that we're going to put into a discussion, and then, of course, our projects. Ready to dig in post-episode 200.
Yes. 202, somehow meaningless. Let's move on.
It's just a real shame.
You're not special for another 98 episodes. Sorry, hate to break it to you.
You can't do it on the 50? All right. So what do we got for news?
Well, I've got a large steaming pile of news this week. English is funny. Steaming on its own has positive connotations, a steaming broth, a chilly day. Pile is more or less neutral, that pile of rocks, but steaming and pile together, and it evokes exactly one thing, which has nothing to do with our news this week, and I apologize for that little twisted insight into the inner workings of my mind. Anyhow, so I'll start out with the Python releases. There were two announcements separated by a day, I assume having something to do with how the releases got signed off.
Yeah.
Between the two announces, there were three releases, 3.11.9 and 3.12.3, which are both bug releases. And then, of course, it's been a while since I've said alpha, so 3.13 alpha 6, which is supposed to be the last alpha before feature freeze, which is less than a month away.
So just after PyCon, we're going to be seeing a feature freeze.
And I think that's usually when they do it, so that they can do a scrum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Next bit of release news is Django. 5.0.4 came out. It's also a bug fix. It's got five or six little bugs in it. And as of the beginning of April, 3.2 has officially reached its end of long-term support, which means the only pre-5 release that's still out there being supported is the 4.2 LTS, which still has two more years to go. For those of us who maintain third-party Django libraries, 3.2 being gone is great because that shrinks the test matrix nicely.
Just a note on that. Your book, which version is it addressing?
It's 5, yes. 5, yeah. Okay. It was 5 was in beta when I was digging in, and 5, Django doesn't really care very much about large version numbers. There are changes, there are new features in 5, but it's not like 5 is a breaking against 4.
Yeah.
So honestly, it was like add a few paragraphs in the book. That was about it. I covered a couple of the new features in the appropriate places, and there wasn't much else to do from there.
Good.
Up until now, the PyCoders newsletter has tracked PEP stuff kind of arbitrarily. We sort of depending on what popped up and what was getting traction on the interwebs. moving forward, we're going to try to be a little more explicit about our coverage. Any PEP added to the PEP repo and any PEP marked as approved is going to get called out in the news section. This will be in addition to the arbitrary coverage. So if there's a lot of discussion for a certain PEP, or there have been, you know, wider appeal or some deep info or something, they'll still be in, say, the articles or other parts of the newsletter. But as part of this, two PEPs recently got approved. The first one was PEP 738, which is about adding Android as a supported platform. And the second is PEP 742, which is about TypeIs, which is a typing mechanism for narrowing down a type's classification.
So that's cool. We got both iOS and Android, both as supported platforms now.
Yeah, and I think that was kind of what was driving it. I think iOS has been there a while, and so I think they just sort of said, hey, we should step up and get it on both kinds of platforms.
Yeah, cool.
And what's that? You want even more news? And like I said, it's a pile. two conferences that I want to talk about quickly. The first is EuroPython, whose tickets are now on sale. EuroPython is from July 8th to the 14th, and it's in Prague this year, as well as being available virtually. Prague's a beautiful city, one of my favorites in Europe. Although it was occupied in World War II, it is far enough east that very few of the bombers made it there. So it's really got a wide variety of original examples of European architecture. By contrast, most of Western Europe is kind of Disney World. It all got demolished and then they pretended and rebuilt it and it's fake. So Prague's a great place to sort of see the historic stuff. It's a beautiful city.
The OG.
And the other conference is PyCon Portugal has been announced. It's going to be from October 17th to the 19th, and they currently have a call for papers out.
Nice.
If you want to speak at a conference, go submit. I can't say for this one in particular, but oftentimes the smaller regional conferences are a little easier to get into. So if you're new to the speaking circuit, this is probably a good place to start. So if you're based in Europe already, Portugal is a nice little hop and it's a nice country, go get your talkie on. All right, that was a lot. What's in your pile, Mr. Bailey? Anything steaming or otherwise?
I have a real Python tutorial. This one is by Harrison Hoffman. Harrison's kind of a newer author for us, and he likes to focus on a lot of stuff in the data science world. I think we featured a couple of things from him before, but this one is about PyDantic, which is actually going to come up several times, I think, throughout the rest of this episode. I think PyDantic is a great name for this library. I think it's pretty perfect. The title is PyDantic, Simplifying Data Validation in Python. This one digs into not only data validation and making sure that that stuff is set up properly going into your different fields and projects and stuff like that, but it also has a little bit to do with managing settings. The first line of the whole thing is PyDantic is a powerful data validation and settings management library for Python, engineered to enhance the robustness and reliability of your code base. I know that this library has come up many times on the show because it's kind of a thing that's tied into a lot of other libraries. We also, I think, mentioned recently their move to Rust. We celebrate many times the advantages to dynamic typing that Python provides, but there are a lot of circumstances where when and where you need it, you need to be sure of like what you're dealing with as far as data goes. And so robust type checking and data validation are handy tools that this thing provides. The tutorial digs in initially with a section titled Getting Familiar and a list of overall features, customization, where you can start with really basic primitives and move into really highly nested data structures that maybe suit your particular project. A lot of flexibility as far as how strict or lax that you want to be, and the ability that you can course things, move them in, say, you have an int and you want to make sure that everything that is an int is turned into a float or whatever in a particular field. Conversions to and from various formats, you know, things like dictionaries and other data structures you're familiar with. You know, there's going to be some JSON in there. And performance, as I mentioned just a second ago, Rust is at the core of it for validation. And then as far as an ecosystem and industry adoption, it is pretty widely accepted. And especially if you've heard of any recent API libraries, FastAPI being the first one I can think of. And we were talking offline just before we began. You mentioned Ninja uses this also, or Django Ninja uses PyDantic also. LangChain, Polars, a few other tools. It's very popular in the community for these types of tools. The tutorial digs into installation. I think the interesting part to mention in there is that it can include optional dependencies. And so you can kind of customize it as you're pip installing it. In this case, they give an example of adding email validation, which is not something that comes by default, but you can add a custom thing that comes in with it that helps with validating that. And then you really start off to the races practicing a lot of things. If you've never worked with a library like this and worked on validating input and making sure things are set right, there's base models. And so you start talking about how to use those, lots of code examples for you to follow along with. I really like that it shows not only things working correctly and correctly validating, but also lots of failures and very descriptive output that you get from that. You get into using fields for customization and metadata. That's where you start to work with this sort of idea of a validator and validating models and fields and creating your own custom validation logic, making sure like somebody's age is at the right level that you want. And you can say, oh, this is an application for a job and they need to be at least 18 years old. You can set up custom fields that are validated in that kind of way. There's also a way to use a validation decorator that can validate functions, and it talks about how to write custom validation logic for that. And then the end of it digs into an area that I wasn't aware of, and maybe a lot of people aren't as aware of, that this is available from the library, but it has a whole thing for managing and working with settings for different projects that you're working on. Very often, again, this type of tool is useful when you're working with databases, you're working with web type of stuff, you're working with other people entering things that are going to go into your program. It's really good that you aren't sharing your settings, sharing your environment variables, making those things private and public and so forth, and making sure that that stuff is, again, validated and proper and so forth. And so there's a whole section on that, which I thought was really great. There's a base settings model for that that'll parse and validate the environment variables. And again, lots of code examples there at the end of proper and improper use, along with all the kind of communication that you get back when there are validation errors. So thanks, Harrison. I think it's a really great tutorial and a great introduction to anyone. And also, again, if you haven't played around with the settings features that are available in it, I think this is a good add-on. Also, if you've been working with anything like APIs, you should have a look at it. And I was wondering, Chris, like, I don't know if you are using a validator type of tool like this. I mentioned Ninja because we were talking about that before we began, but what types of things are you using for like projects where, again, human beings are going to be entering data into your Django and so forth?
Yes. So I've used Pydantic indirectly through Ninja because Ninja essentially just subclasses the Pydantic classes, and it's used to validate. Ninja's a library for doing REST. And so you're getting JSON fields going back and forth between client and server, and you want to make sure that the client isn't sending you the wrong one. And so they're using Pydantic to manage all of that. And in fact, they've got decorators on their decorators, essentially. So you can say this is an update call, which in HTTP is called a put. And so you can say this is the Pydantic model that is going to be used for the content that's coming in, and this is the Pydantic model for the response that's going out. And one of the beauties of Pydantic is it's got a to dictionary call on it.
Yeah, yeah.
So once it's been validated, you don't have to use the class anymore. You can just stick it in a dictionary. And so you can essentially do this kind of validation at one layer in your program and then not have to worry about it. Once it's clean, you can pass it elsewhere. Django has its own mechanisms for this stuff that's connected to the ORM. So before using Ninja, I had been using, you know, the most common place to do it is with things like forms on the web. And Django's got its own form classes, and it does a lot of the same kind of stuff. A
lot of validation already there.
Yeah, it's, you know, because again, well, everything that comes off the web by definition is text, right? Every post is a text, regardless of what it is. And then some system, because it's a big string that gets sent up, and then some system has to change it into what it's supposed to be. And again, Pydantic takes care of this kind of stuff for you. Django's forms takes care of this kind of stuff for you. The Django REST framework, again, trying to solve similar sorts of problems, has its own mechanisms for serialization. So these all sort of touch on those kinds of things. Outside of that, most of it I think I've ever done, it's always been by hand. Because if it's like for a script or something, it's, you know, you ask for some information, you get it back and you go, this is an int. So you cast it to an int. And then when it isn't an int, your program crashes and it throws an exception saying that wasn't an int. And hopefully your user figures out next time to send you an int.
Yeah.
So that's usually why you end up wanting to do this stuff. It makes it friendlier and cleaner.
Yeah. We'll dig into a little bit more of that in my next story when we can get
to that. Yeah, I was about to say that this dovetails nicely into the web security stuff that you're going to be talking about shortly.
This episode is sponsored by Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. Mailtrap is an email sending solution with industry-best analytics, SMTP, and email API SDKs for major programming languages. And it includes 24/7 human support. Try it out for free at mailtrap.io. That's mailtrap.io.
So what do you got for us first here?
So a couple weeks back, Francois Floret posted on Twitter a complaint about a counterintuitive Python thing that cost him hours of his life to debug. This is going to be a bit messy because we're audio only. But let me give it a stab. So in Python, you can multiply a sequence in order to get back a repeated version of that sequence. For example, sometimes when I want to print a dividing line on the screen, I often do 55 times the equal character, and that gives me 55 equal signs in a line.
Yeah, it's funny how that works with strings, where you can just say, I want this many of these letters.
Yeah. I remember discovering it in Python. I think this is the first language I'd seen it in. And I was like, oh, this is beautiful. Like it's a silly little shortcut, but it can be really, really handy.
Yep.
So using this to repeat strings is fairly common, but it works with any sequence. And what gets repeated is the thing inside the sequence. So for strings, that's the character segment in the strings. All right. So now for what Francois had done, or what he came across in his debugging, it's not clear whether it was his fault or whether it was somebody else's code. we'll get into that. He essentially had taken an empty list inside of an empty list and then multiplied that by 4. And so like with the characters in the string, what you get is 4 empty lists inside of the list, because you get that repetition happening.
Right.
So now the bug part. He then appended a value to the first empty list. And the surprise he got was, when he examined it, he ended up with that 4 times. Each of the sub-lists inside the master had the same value.
Yeah, he did.
So let me try that one more time. So you create an empty list, and inside of that, it has an empty list. Multiply the outside by 4, like store the whole thing in A, and then do A square bracket 0 dot append the string seriously. And when you look at A, what you have is a list with seriously and another list with seriously and a third and a fourth. So that's the background for this article.
Yeah.
The article itself is from Abhinav Abade, and he saw Francois' tweet and wrote a post called "Why Do Python Lists Multiply Oddly?" where he explains just what happened to Francois. Abhinav starts out by agreeing the result is counterintuitive, sort of brushes off the debate as to whether or not it's correct. His focus is merely on the why.
Yeah.
And the short explanation for this is, wait for it, everything in Python is an object. Nice. When you multiply the list inside the list, what you're getting is 4 references to the exact same inner list. Hence, when you append to the first one, you're actually appending to all of them because there's really only one. You've got 4 references to the same list. Abhinav demonstrates this by building a list comprehension based on that list, which has the which uses the ID function inside of it. If you haven't seen this before, C Python has a specific built-in function that gives you an identifier for an object. So if 2 references point to the same object, you'll get back the same number from ID for both of them. So when you run this on that same list, the seriouslys, what you'll see is the same single identifier 4 times. Abhinav's post is on Substack, and the rest of it is behind a paywall. He was nice enough to give the short explanation to the general public. if you're a Substack subscriber, the post goes on to describe the CPython internals of lists in more details and essentially explains why the aforementioned counterintuitive behavior is the way it is. This kind of reminds me of default thought values in function arguments.
Yep. I just wrote that down. Yeah. You don't want to put an empty list up there.
Yeah. It's really important to know in Python when you're passing around multiple copies of the same object reference versus when you're creating a new object. It doesn't come up that often, which makes it that much harder to realize what has gone wrong if you've made the incorrect assumption and can make the code a little counterintuitive and tricky.
Yeah, mutability is a big part of it, you know, why it behaves that way. But yeah, it's that whole, everything's an object. And this goes back to several conversations that we've had. Thank you for adding that.
You have to warn me. I'm not fast enough on it.
All right, trigger button.
I think part of it is like a lot of most programming languages make a distinction between the object and a pointer to the object.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everything in Python is references, it doesn't need to do that. In C, you'd be making this mistake all the time. And then you'd be like, oh, right, I meant ampersand when I used star or vice versa. Because in Python, this is an edge case, I think it's that much trickier simply because 99.9% of the time, you are not going to have this problem. And then that 0.1% takes a big toothy chunk out of your rear end and
yeah.
It costs you time.
I feel like it's an important thing to cover, you know, to make sure that people understand it. I know that we have tried in lots of our tutorials to have like one lesson that says, hey, watch out for this thing that might bite you. So
yeah, and even as an instructor, though, like even when you spend time on this kind of thing, it's one of those where, you know, if you're new to the language and you're trying to learn all these things, it's just one in a long list of things you've learned. And it's right. Hard to stick that in your head. And again, because you're not using it that often, you don't run into it frequently. I know the first time I came across the problem of a list in the as a default in the arguments, and I read about why not to do it, I don't know that the explanation actually sunk in. I just sort of left with this sure. vague yeah. feeling of, oh, you shouldn't do that. And then the next time I came across it, I was like, okay, I think I'm not supposed to do this. Why am I not supposed to do that? I looked it up. So it was probably about like the third or fourth time that I ran into it where I'm like, no, just use none.
Yeah, yeah.
Do, you know, and then validate from there. And in particular, if you're coming from other languages where you're like, oh, great, now I don't have to deal with this pointer stuff. And then all of a sudden you're in this edge case where it's like, wait a second, that's almost like a pointer thing. So yeah, it's an easy enough mistake to make.
Yeah, totally. So as hinted before, my next one is from Arjan Codes. It's titled Best Python Security Practices for Web Developers. I think about this often. Anybody's developed tutorials or as a beginner gone through lots of tutorials, there's things that you just don't think about as you're developing a tool in the privacy of your home environment. So now you want to deploy that tool to the internet for quote unquote anyone to use, and who's going to touch it and what's going to happen. So this is actually talking about that idea of like, okay, switch your mindset. What are all the things you got to consider now as sort of security practices, now that something's going to be up on the web? And it's hard as a Python developer to like, you know, kind of count this in because it's sort of outside of the, I don't know. It's kind of one of these things that this is where you are starting to graduate, you know, you're moving beyond the idea of just writing, working code. And now you're having to think about like, well, how's it going to behave out in the wild and how are people going to behave interacting with it? So this is like 7 points with kind of a paragraph and of ideas, lots of links and other kinds of stuff beyond it. I won't harp on every single one, but the first one I thought, you know, is perfect because it's what we were just talking about. Validate your inputs and sanitize data. And we spent quite a time digging into sort of the how. This really talks about more of the why. You know, why should you be thinking about that in this sort of section? And Pydantic is a great tool for something like this to validate what your input is and potentially, you know, sanitizing the data or coursing it or, again, changing formats, serializing into, you know, like you said, going from something like JSON to a dictionary or whatever. In that process, you should be validating what's happening in there and making sure that things are properly prepared. The second one is use secure coding libraries and tools. And he offers different tools that are within the Python ecosystem for this, some libraries and tools for you to sort of enhance your security. A couple that are mentioned that I think are really good that I have not only had mentioned to me by guests of the show that are talking about this and setting up things. One is called Bandit. It's a very popular one that can scan your code base for security issues. It's updated all the time, kind of looks at common vulnerabilities that could be within your code base. So that one's very popular. He mentions another one called Pip Audit. And so, yeah, kind of looking at things that can help you look at what's happening inside your stuff and maybe trip you up. I know in some various Django tutorials that I've gone through, the author had like, here's a list of things that you can think about now that you're going to try to deploy this. Here's some steps you might do. And there are other tutorials out there that might help you in that. Keeping your Python and libraries up to date. This one is an interesting one to think about. There are tools. We mentioned pip already, but pip has a feature, if you have never used it, pip space list dash dash outdated. And that will actually tell you in your current environment or setup that you're working with here, what versions are you looking at and what would be quote unquote outdated. And then you can run upgrade. Poetry has a similar feature. He provides a resource if you aren't familiar with Poetry, which is a very popular tool for managing dependencies and packaging. And again, as a resource for you to dig a little bit further. I wonder a little bit about that, potential issues with this approach, troubleshooting the changes if you're going to update a particular library that was working properly with your code base. There also kind of, it feels like there's like a window of time where the updates kind of make sense. Do you want to always be doing this like once a month or something like that? I think you could kind of get into a nightmare scenario where you're like constantly looking at problems there. Potentially, you're going to be rerunning all the steps that are mentioned in this particular tutorial. And so I wanted to run this by you, Chris, like having somebody who's worked in an organization a little bit more, was there something that the organization set as far as like a policy? Like, hey, we need to update the libraries and pay attention to what versions we're keeping as current?
Most of the places I worked, and particularly the ones where it was my responsibility to think about this kind of crap, it just kind of happened ad hoc.
Okay. It wasn't like the 6-month audit thing.
It's probably not a bad idea, but then you also have to remember that like a significant chunk of my experience in that is back when the web was a little bit of a safer place. So
Yeah, true. Yeah.
You know, I have Cloudflare in front of the sites I run right now, and somewhere between 90 and 95% of my traffic is not traffic. It's people looking for holes.
Yeah, it's bot stuff.
Right? So, it's astounding how quickly, you put something with a vulnerability up, it does not take very long before somebody finds the vulnerability. So I think if I were doing it now, I might be a little more rigorous about it. Hmm. The challenge with it, too, is... like just because there's a new library doesn't mean you have to upgrade.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
But you do want to take a look at, why has the library been patched? And so like if you're, we spend time here talking about, bug fixes and for things like Python and Django and other major libraries, if it says bug fix, look at it and go, that's a bug fix for this particular feature. Oh, well, we don't use it. So then, okay, maybe we'll wait.
Okay.
Or we do use it. So, okay, let's, and then there's also severity of it as well, right? So, the last couple patches, I think it was one patch before, I think it was 503 for Django. The thing they fixed was a denial of service. So unless someone is targeting you and trying to cause this to happen, you might get away with that. And so there's a difference between do I need to upgrade because of that versus, hey, I'm about to expose my credentials. And that's a whole other kind of thing, right? So I think you kind of have to pay a bit of attention.
So maybe like read what's in the release notes. That's a habit.
Yeah, no, looking at the release notes and figuring out what they're fixing and whether it actually impacts your software, because you may or may not be using that part of the library.
Yeah.
And, what are the trade-offs? And then, not that I'm a shill for Cloudflare, but them and tools like them can help as well, so that they're putting another layer in front of you on the web.
Yeah.
So the Open World Application Software Project, which is OWASP, they maintain a list of the top 10 vulnerabilities. And it's, I think the word I'm looking for is depressing.
That they have a top 10 list, yeah.
So like injection attacks, SQL injection in particular, has been in the top 3 for like since the beginning.
Right.
right? For over 20 years, right? And there's absolutely no reason for that besides people writing SQL by hand and
not sanitizing at all.
And not sanitizing. And I think this kind of comes back to the, hey, use the libraries, right? Like, never try to write your own crypto. If you're writing SQL, do not write SQL text by hand. Use something like SQL Alchemy because it does all that escaping for you, right? Like, the correct selection of certain libraries gives you, it's not a guarantee, but it gets you further away from the low-hanging fruit in for the bad actors.
It also makes you not, it gives you back some of your time.
Yes,
there and is not that. Having to become a security
Well, you don't have to person. Be an expert in it. Yeah. Well, and honestly, some of it too is always just a bug. Like, the first time I came across SQL injection, it was in the 90s. I was using a commercial formed tool, and I was entering some, like, it had a hook, and so I was coding for the hook. And all I was doing was some testing, and I there was like a comment field we had in the form, and I wrote something with a semicolon in it. I wasn't trying to break anything, and I didn't know enough about SQL at the time to know that that would be something you should test for. And I put in a semicolon, and the server fell over.
Ooh.
And it took me hours to figure out, well, why is it crashing? I assumed it was my code. And then I finally figured out, it was the semicolon that was doing it. And then I got under the hood and saw what it was doing. And I'm like, oh my God, they're not escaping any of this. And whatever I typed after the semicolon, it was treating it as a SQL statement. And, yeah. And the fact that that was in a commercial product in the 90s is embarrassing. And it's more embarrassing that 30 years later, we're still having this problem.
Yeah, yeah. Right? It's top three. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
The fourth one I think is really good. And it's, again, that idea that you're switching from working in the sort of home environment. And these tools try to warn you about this. But yeah, implement error handling and logging wisely. If you run most things in default mode, the developer-centric mode is a real oversharing kind of thing. It wants to tell you everything that's going on, and that can be exploited in big ways. So avoiding sort of accidental information leakage and making sure that you're sort of sanitizing the other direction, not what's coming in, but what potentially could be out, and, you know, setting debug to false in production and things like that. I'll skip one here. I'll go down to HTTPS, which is something that hopefully you can set up for free through some different tools. Let's Encrypt is a free SSL TLS certificate that can be, I've set up things where it's automated, which is nice and can help you create those certificates. And then the last one is conduct regular security audits and reviews. And so I was wondering if there's any tools that you like to suggest or use that kind of fall in here. I don't want to take up a ton of time, but...
So not so much a specific tool, but a category of them.
Okay.
So fuzzers, shakers, people call them different things, but the stuff that randomly generates content and spits it at your screen, it can be really, really helpful. Because that will discover things like the semicolons, because it will randomly generate a semicolon, and then your stuff will fall over, right?
Right.
That whole concept of automatically generating crap and seeing whether or not your form handles it properly makes a big difference. I've used with my clients tools like SonarQube before, which isn't technically for security, but it checks some of that kind of stuff as it's looking for other code quality. I think what I would encourage is make it part of your CI/CD process, right? So you want this because you don't want it something that developers have to consciously do. You want it something that runs nightly on your repo or runs every single time somebody makes a commit or something along those lines. And again, this comes back to your earlier point of you don't have to become a security expert. Go stand on the shoulders and let the people who know how to do this stuff tell you that you're doing it wrong and fix it, right?
Yeah. Recent sponsor. We've had several sponsors in this vein, but most recently, Sentry is another tool that you can look at for things like this too that can help look through your code base and tools. So awesome. Cool. And we have a link to that top 10 if you're interested. Chris sent it over to me. This week, I want to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. In your Python journey, you'll come across situations where you need to signal that something is going wrong in your code. And this video course digs into the topic and is titled Using Rays for Effective Exceptions. The course is based on a real Python tutorial by Leodana Esposo Ramos. The video course instructor is my frequent co-host, Christopher Trudeau, and he explains how to raise exceptions in Python using the raise statement, decide which type of exception to raise and when you should raise them in your code. You'll explore the common use cases for raising exceptions in Python, and you'll learn how to apply best practices for raising those exceptions within your Python code. I think it's a worthy investment of your time to learn how to raise exceptions properly in Python and be ready for managing those situations, like where a file doesn't exist, a network or database connection fails, or your code gets invalid input. Real Python video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the technique shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the enhanced search tool on realpython.com. So what's your next topic you want to get into?
Yeah, I've got another article where the background required to understand the article is longer than the article itself. It seems to have been a theme for me this week. The article's called Inline Run Dependencies in PipX 1.4.2, and it's by Henry Schreiner. So first bit of background on PipX. You know how it's best practice to use virtual environments for all your Python projects? Well, that makes it problematic to use Python scripts as a dedicated tool, because then you end up having to activate the virtual environment to use the tool. The solution to this is PipX. PipX automatically creates and manages virtual environments for you and also adds the binary folder from the environment into your path. Essentially, it lets you install Python packages as if they were a standalone application. So for more information on using PipX, there's a real Python tutorial by Bartosz Zaczynski, and it's called Install and Execute Python Applications Using PipX, which we'll link to in the show notes.
Yeah.
So the second bit of background that you need to understand Henry's article is PEP 723. This is called Inline Script Metadata. As Python is a scripting language and it's common to just pass a single script file around, email it to a friend or something, it can be a little problematic if a script file has dependencies. So once you start getting dependencies involved, you move away from the simplicity of, hey, I'll just mail Chris a file, to, hey, here now I have to set up a package and infrastructure and all that kind of crap. Speaking of steaming piles, package management. So PEP 723 outlines a structure that can be used inside of a single file program to specify what that script's dependencies are. And how this works is through the use of special characters inside of a comment at the top of the file. And it essentially allows you to put in the part of a PyProject toml right into the file itself inside of the comment. And with the right tools, then it can be taken care of. Now, if I understand the PEP correctly, this means no changes to Python itself. It's only a side specification for tools. So the folks behind Hatch, for example, have already committed to supporting this feature. And essentially, if you're using a script like this, and one, I don't know whether Hatch has got it implemented yet, but once they do, you'd say Hatch run and then that script, and it will take care of all that management virtual env stuff. That's the background, which then I guess makes this the foreground. There's a Unix %1 joke in there somewhere, but it would probably be too esoteric and would fail the primary requirement of a joke. It wouldn't be funny. Anyways, Henry's article on PipX 142 announces that PipX now supports the PEP 723 feature. So although the PipX folks weren't behind the PEP, they have built it into their tool. If you do PipX run on a script that uses the new dependency format, PipX figures out whether to create a new virtual environment for you or not, or will use an existing one, and then uses that environment to run your script. So, you know, one of the beauties of Python is kind of always been its low barrier to entry. And, you know, if you want to quickly slap some code together, no problem, as long as you've got the interpreter. You don't have to worry about compilation and how you named your file, a whole bunch of other stuff that can get complicated with other languages.
Right.
And as Python's gone from a pure scripting language to a way of building complex software, this simplicity's gone away a bit. And PEP 723 sort of resets that. It makes it a little easier to take advantage of third-party tools, even for short scripts. And it's great that PipX is now supporting this.
It seems like a cleaner way to do it. I'm wondering if there were other workarounds that were maybe potentially a little more broken in the past.
I remember there being a couple different stabs at this PEP, and I think more or less the conversation was about the argument of the format of the contents of the comment more than anything else. I think there was some conversation. I think there's actually a subsection on the PEP that says, and why we won't use requirements.txt. So there's obviously been some conversations about that.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, it's, there's a big part of our community that really are just doing, you know, data cleaning scripts that are one-offs. Well, if you want to use NumPy in your data cleaning script, now you don't have to. You can just put the requirements in the piece and it'll work properly.
Nice. So that leads us to our discussion. And in this particular case, we took a couple different, recent articles that kind of touched on to the idea of contributing to open source. One is a much more personal journey story, but very interesting. And I think it hints at to a couple things here. And the other is, I don't want to say controversial, but like definitely brings up some potentially, I don't know, I like the word problematic activity that has been going on. So do you want to do the intro here?
Sure, fine. So the first article is called So Your Teacher Wants You to Do Open Source, and it's by David Lord. This one could also be subtitled, Yeah, Just Don't. Every September and many Januaries, one of the main Python discussion boards gets inundated with posts saying, Hi, my name is, and pretty much nothing else. After a bit of investigation, moderators have figured out that there's a university whose coding course has an exercise which includes go create an account and introduce yourself on the discussion boards. And somebody did some digging. 95% of these folks have made an account, only post hello world, and then never post again. And the moderators are in the process of trying to stop this, and it sounds like they're making progress. And I'm sure none of this was meant as malicious, merely trying to teach the students where they could learn more and get some help.
Right.
The knock-on effect, though, is blasting the forum with useless posts. And David's article mentions this case briefly, along with some other patterns that he's seen while maintaining an open source project, where, you know, some instructor has said, hey, student, go make a contribution to a project. And the problem isn't so much that the intention here is wrong, but that the students often aren't given any guidance.
Yeah.
So you end up with a bad commit message, missing tests, failure to follow the project's conventions, and other kinds of problems.
It leaves all the work on the other side, which
is fundamentally what it comes down to. So, you know, one of the ones that David mentions is, students trying to be helpful by running code quality tools on the repo and then submitting all the changes, right? So, and these changes might conflict with existing style, or they're using a different code quality tool than the one the project's using already.
Yeah.
And evidently there's a new bump in this little road, which is people are starting to use AI tools to help do things like fix the documentation. Can you hear the word, the air quotes around my word fix there?
Yeah.
The common thread through all this is whether or not the instructor's intentions are good, the end result is work for the maintainer to separate the wheat from the chaff. And most maintainers are volunteers, and every minute spent doing this is a minute they can't actually put into the project itself. So this impacts all of us.
Yeah.
The second article, which has some sort of similar flavors to it here, is from Rodrigo Giraro-Serraro's article titled 503 Days Working Full-Time on FOSS, Lessons Learned. Rodrigo was formerly at Textualize, which is the company behind Rich and Textual. And this post talks about his experience there. He spends a bit of time talking about the fact that he learned a lot from his coworkers, but the article is mostly focused on things he learned by interacting with users and contributors. Two of the key takeaways he talks about are creating a contribution guide and giving clear instructions on how to report a bug. And this ties back to the essence of David's article, right? Maintainers only have so much time, and Rodrigo's advice is really trying to give as much guidance as possible to contributors to help maximize the use of the maintainer's time, which minimizes the amount of follow-up and, you know, the circling back and all the rest of that kind of stuff. So for a discussion, I seem to be talking a lot. So
you got a lot in there.
Yeah. Wade in. We'll pretend this is actually a conversation.
So I shook my head when I read David Lord's one and thought to myself, wow, that teacher really just took away all the responsibility for this thing and just unshackled it and said, just go do this thing. And I was like, quote unquote, shocked that it went poorly.
Yeah.
But also just shocked myself that somebody would, you know, have just, it's just such a wrong way, headed way to do that. So I thought of like different ways that I could potentially help the situation as a teacher, like what I would do in that sense. And one of the ideas I had was like kind of this idea of a mock project, you know, you might have like a mock trial or a mock other kind of thing, like create a situation. You know, a lot of educational institutions, especially if it's a university, have projects themselves that they do and set them up, have a form of governance inside there, have people practice the idea of interacting with that, do that, do the experiments and potentially the weird hi, hello kind of stuff inside your own little thing. And then once people kind of got an idea how to drive, you know, driver's education isn't part of school anymore, I guess, right? So really dating myself at that point. Make sure that that's happening inside and kind of grade that performance. I think that would be one way to do it. Or, okay, teach the person how to teach themselves by saying, okay, you need to go and tell me what the governance page is for this project. And so as an example, I pulled up the governance page for the Palettes project because that's something that David mentioned in there. Palettes project is Flask and a variety of other things that we've mentioned several times. So what's on like the governance page? Well, like the code of conduct, all the different resources, they have a section called structure, which is like how the Palettes project is structured and who makes what decisions where. Of course, a thing for source code, rules and guidelines about the source code. And that actually includes Python and JavaScript style guides. So hopefully that would avoid the let me just reformat everything for you so it looks better, black kind of run thing or AI thing there. And it's not even very long. It's like two pages that you can look through and see the Python style guide and see where and what the rules are set to. And so that would at least give you an idea of like, okay, what are the types of things I could do? And then I thought, you know, not everybody getting started in open source, and I've mentioned this many times with other guests, the idea of like, well, do you have to contribute code as a first-time contribution and potential mistakes with that? Maybe you can learn a lot by doing other things. And so this idea of like how to orient yourself to what the project is and the anatomy of it. And so I found this guide. It's called How to Contribute to Open Source, sort of general open source guides. So I'll include that link also. It provides this quote of like every open source community is different, which is true. You're going to run into how things are very different inside there. But one of the things I liked about it is it actually starts with this section of other potential ways that you can contribute. Do you like to plan events? Are you that type of person? So DjangoCon, FlaskCon, there's all these different open source projects. If they're in your area, maybe planning that event or being involved in that could be one.
Even if they're not in your area, some of the bigger ones will even give travel stipends if you're willing to come down and volunteer.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a great way to get involved. You're definitely going to meet people and you can ask all those burning questions about things. Have people that you can kind of interact with that. Do you like to do design was the next one. Do you like to write? So that could be documentation, other things like that, or tutorials and things like that. Do you like organizing? That means not necessarily the planning of events, but more like, are you an organized person so you could manage issues or PRs or, you know, just keeping the project generally organized? Do you like to help people? So that kind of goes back to a lot of the stuff that's in Rodrigo's of like other people are trying to contribute. And so there's lots of all these other jobs you can be doing in open source that aren't directly like, I'm going to fix this code and change it. And that often is the help that I'm not going to argue is missing, but in a lot of cases, maybe if you go to a project and you see there isn't much documentation and you feel like that you could be helpful in that way, this is a huge thing. And the other thing they mentioned at the very bottom of that is like, you don't have to work on software projects. There are other ways to get your GitHub chops down and practice things like creating awesome lists, curating things like that. Maybe you're making lists of potential interview questions and other things like that, like things that you can kind of practice using some of these tools that isn't necessarily going to become work for the other maintainers. So I like that. those are the things I found kind of quickly that I thought might be useful. I did like what Rodrigo was mentioning. He got real close to interacting on that project, and he learned a lot of process and learned how to accept advice, how to do code reviews and things like that. And so I think maybe that's a little bit what's missing from that teacher's conversation there. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a couple of things that both articles kind of talked about sort of patience directly or indirectly. Rodrigo's article also sort of touched on the ego thing as well. Just to flip it to the maintainer side, maintainers need to be better at understanding where the contributors are coming from. And the flip side of it is contributors often are very demanding, as if they have a right to something being fixed or working a certain way or whatever, right? Like, I've been recently attempting to put in a PR or prepare a PR for Django Ninja. There's a feature I think should be in there. And from my own sense of time, I don't want to spend a whole bunch of time on the PR and then have it rejected. It'll suck for me. It's a waste of my time. It's a waste of their time. So like, there's been a little bit of back and forth in the issues. And when we get it worked out, then I'll actually create the PR, right? And, you know, from a patient's point of view, if it goes nowhere, great. One of the primary maintainers of Ninja is lives in Ukraine, and he disappears for weeks at a time, and
can't imagine why.
And yeah. I can't imagine why. Like, it's that's hard enough when you live somewhere where your country isn't currently at war. So you never know what's behind the interaction you're having with those folks. So as a contributor, you need to understand that people might go away for a little while. And as a maintainer, you also have to don't feel like you have to answer everything every last second, because that's unreasonable as well, right? I think we have to kind of remember this is a human endeavor based on volunteers all the way up and all the way down.
I wonder a little bit, this is kind of touching on something that you mentioned briefly, the whole go onto their Discord server and introduce yourself and so forth. What do you think of that practice? Like, I think it's a mixed bag as far as like what projects have a Discord server. The project I'm going to mention this week actually has one, and it's like seems to be the only way where you can really interact with the project. Like, I was trying to find more information about like, well, if I wanted to contribute, like what are the guidelines and what are the things you would do? I'm guessing that stuff's on their Discord, but I have not gotten in the big habit of like digging into those things.
Yeah, it varies wildly from project to project. Django has recently started something called Django Knots. I don't know if you've heard about this.
Yeah, I've been seeing lots of posts. Yeah.
And they are essentially, it's not a Django boot camp. It's a contributors boot camp's the wrong word. But the idea isn't, hey, come here and learn Django. The idea here is, hey, if you'd like to contribute, they're providing guidance to groups of people on how to how to help out. And one of the things they're doing is, sometimes PRs will get halfway done. Somebody will like write the code but won't write the test, and then they'll disappear. So the maintainers, they can pass this to a Django Knot person, and so that they've got volunteers sort of helping to mentor folks into this process. And they're doing it by keeping cohorts. So this isn't a wide open program. You have to say, put your hand up for, I can't remember, it's like 8 weeks, 12 weeks, something
apply,
like that.
If you will.
Apply to do it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they're looking both for volunteers to help mentor and people who are actually interested in doing this. But I think it's an interesting model.
Yeah.
And they...
Very structured. That's good.
Yeah. And what they're... I remember listening to a podcast. They were talking about how they're structuring it, and they were inspired by somebody else. They're not the first one who's kicked it off, but I don't remember who did it. But they are open sourcing all of their documents and their recommendations, all the rest of it. So if you want to try start something like this for your own projects, you can go grab their stuff and use it. And they're asking openly. It's like, well, try it, change one of the rules, see what works for you. Tell us if changing that rule works or doesn't work.
Yeah.
So there seems to be a movement towards trying to figure out how to provide some of this kind of guidance.
Cool.
Yeah. The instructor thing, I think, has probably just been, it's just a naive mistake, not really realizing the consequence.
Yeah, and now it's like been solidified over years, it sounds like, if they're trying to find the individual and go, can you stop?
And the challenge with it, particularly with, you know, like with a programming 101 course, is you might have 300 students and that kind of thing in some of the bigger universities, right? So all of a sudden you got 300 people blasting your posts, right? So it's not an easy thing, and we should all try to be better people. You first.
Thank you. And good luck. Exactly. All right. Well, let's dig into projects. Mine is really quick and easy, and I love that about it. It's called Nava. I'm guessing that's how to pronounce it. It's NAVA, and the subtitle is "Play Sounds in Python." The project is from Open Science Lab. Nava is a Python library that allows users to play sound in Python without any dependencies or platform restrictions. Caveat, I tried it on my own Mac M1 Pro on Sonoma, and it worked great. No problems. I played audio. It's a very simple library to just pip install. It's very lightweight in some ways, which I liked. And the idea behind it is, you want to play sound, you want to add that to your project. Very often there were lots of large dependencies that did kind of massive things. You know, they played video and audio and did all this other stuff and conversions and so forth. This just plays audio. And so, like on Linux, it uses the engine called the Advanced Linux Sound Architecture. Supported formats are Wave. Windows, it uses WinSound and Wave. And then on macOS, it has something called Audio File Play that it uses. And on Mac, you get the advantage of not only Wave, but you can play also MP3s. Currently version 0.5. And like I said, I installed it via pip, played around with it, played different audio files, was able to get a couple different things playing, just kind of messing around in the REPL. And I think, again, if you want, I hate to use the word simple, but if you want, again, a small library that can get you playing sound in your Python project, check out Nava. What's your project?
I'm going to keep it short as well, because I've been yammering a lot this week. This is almost more of a shout out than a project-y thing. It's called PyCountry. It's a third-party library that maintains information on countries and the stuff that goes with them. Close to 30 contributors here, and this is used by more than 18,000 other repos on GitHub, so this is a useful tool. Code-wise, it couldn't be simpler. It's essentially a wrapper around Debian's ISO country library. So inside of it, you'll find all the countries on the ISO list, their names, their 2- and 3-letter country code short forms, official full names, currency information, language information, in some cases, even the Unicode flag. The objects can be found through a fuzzy search things, so you don't have to know the exact name. You can convert them to dictionaries. It's got a mechanism for customizing the data set in memory. So if you've got a country you need to add or want to make up a country, want to become a country, you could do that in your code. And there's also a historical repository so that you can get at country information for countries that don't exist anymore. The topic of what is and what isn't a country can sometimes be contentious. And this is why this library is a wrapper to the Debian one. They essentially say, we do not have any input in this. If you wish to argue with that, here's the link to the Debian list. So go argue with them.
Go in that direction.
Exactly. There's a lot of good data in here, which can be useful for internationalization or things like populating that, you know, that country drop down or addresses or on invoice forms, that kind of stuff. So very useful little library. And thanks to all those folks that are helping to maintain it.
Yeah, that's a great collection of stuff. Again, it's nice to have stuff collected for you in a nice little package you can take advantage of. Well, Christopher, thanks for bringing all these articles and projects and discussion topics. Thanks again.
Always happy to be here.
And don't forget, this episode was brought to you by Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. Try it out for free at mailtrap.io. I want to thank Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast.
And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.